And now, The Mentors Radio, one of the most popular and unique shows on the air today. Here each week, remarkable CEOs and leaders, including host Tom Laurie and Dan Hesse, and their guest will mentor you, challenging your thinking about life and work. Sought after for their ethical leadership and advice, and for helping others succeed throughout their careers, now these same CEOs, the mentors, want to help you achieve your highest level of profitability, success, and personal fulfillment in life, at work, and in business. Learn more and check out the show notes at thementorsradio.com. That's thementorsradio.com. And now, here's your mentor.
Welcome. I'm your host, Dan Hesse. Today's guest is David Rubenstein, co-founder and co-chairman of the Carlyle Group, one of the world's largest and most successful private equity firms. In addition to hosting the David Rubenstein Show and other programs on Bloomberg TV and PBS, David fills his empty days by chairing the boards of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, the Council on Foreign Relations, the National Gallery of Art, the Economic Club of Washington, and the University of Chicago. David is also a trustee of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Johns Hopkins Medicine, the Institute for Advanced Study, the National Constitution Center, the Brookings Institution, and the World Economic Forum. He's a director of the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. David is an original signer of the Giving Pledge, and he's a leader in the area of patriotic philanthropy, having made transformative gifts for the restoration or repair of many of America's most important monuments. And he's providing long-term loans to the U.S. government of his rare copies of the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, the first map of the U.S., and the first book printed in the U.S. David recently bought the Baltimore Orioles, and he's the author of four books, and we'll be discussing one of them today, How to Lead. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm going to turn the mic around for a change. You're usually the one who gets to ask the questions, and today I am. But let me start with the first one, with that long list of things that you're involved with. Are you just the master delegator? How do you manage your time? What's your trick?
Well, I don't play golf. That saves a lot of time. I don't drink alcohol. That saves a lot of time as well. I regard the weekends as weekdays. So I, on Saturdays and Sundays, I generally am still working reasonably hard, but everything I'm doing, I enjoy. So when I'm doing them, it's not work. It's just pleasure. And as you know, in life, when you're enjoying something and it's pleasurable, the time goes by very quickly. So I don't really look at it as having too many activities. I have many things I'm doing that I really enjoy.
No, that's great. And I find that to be the case with a number of the leaders that I talk to. But I think in terms of activities, you're in first place. So you grew up in a blue collar area of Baltimore where your father worked for the post office. I think you said he made about $7,000 a year. You had a scholarship to Duke. You get a scholarship to Chicago Law. But you don't practice law for that many years. What made you see the light and leave the law profession?
I practiced for 2 years at a very well-known firm in New York, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison, and I didn't really think I was going to be that great a lawyer. I was okay, but nothing spectacular. And I also saw that the life of being a corporate partner in a large law firm was not going to be as exciting to me as I had thought it might be when I entered law school. And I went to law school not so much to be a corporate lawyer, but to really get involved in politics and government. And I had observed as a young man that those people who went into government and politics usually had a law degree. So I really saw it as a way to get into the political world and the governmental world. And that's what I really did. After 2 years at Paul Weiss, I did go into government in the Capitol Hill and then worked at the White House for 4 years for Jimmy Carter.
So why private equity?
Well, when we lost the reelection campaign to Ronald Reagan in 1980, I had to do something else with my career. And the only thing I knew how to do really was practice law. So I returned to the practice law, this time in Washington, but I wasn't really that great at it because to be really great at something, you have to really enjoy it. It can't be work. It has to be pleasurable. Nobody ever won a Nobel Prize hating what they do. You have to love what you're going to do it well. And I really didn't love the practice of law, which was in Washington, trying to convince people that you could influence a government agency or Congress by using your powers of persuasion or your contacts or something. And I just didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So I read about Bill Simon, who had been a Secretary of the Treasury. After he left as Secretary of Treasury in the Ford administration, he did what was then called a leveraged buyout. He put in, let's say, roughly $1 million of his money, made $80 million in about 18 months in a deal called Gibson Greeting Cards. And I thought that was more pleasurable and more lucrative than practicing law. And so I decided I would try that. But I just would start a small firm with five or six people. And that was all I originally intended. But obviously it grew.
How did it grow to be that large? Especially, you know, you did not have a financial background. How were you able to build this extraordinarily successful company?
Well, I recruited people that knew more about investments than I did. Obviously, they don't have a lot of investment bankers then in Washington, but I recruited people who have been CFOs or in the finance division of companies based in the Washington area. And they knew more about investing than I did, which was obviously very little. But I decided I'd make myself useful by trying to raise money for the organization. And so I made myself into a more or less full-time fundraiser and going around the world and the United States, of course, as well, to kind of suggest to people that they invest with us. But I was able to do that not because I was so persuasive, but because we had a pretty good track record. As we built our firm, my partners who were doing the investing day to day actually had a pretty good track record. So it wasn't that difficult to convince people to give us additional money. And that was the concept of using our track record to raise more money. But I had one idea that did change private equity a bit. The idea was that we wouldn't do just through buyouts, which is what traditionally U.S. firms, they were in the buyout business. That's all they did. They did buyouts. They only did it in the United States. I decided that what I'd like to do is have a multiple number of funds that would do things other than just buyouts. And so just like if you go to a mutual fund, you have many different funds you can pick from. I thought I would try to do the same thing in private equity, which hadn't been done before. So we'd have a buyout fund, a real estate fund, a growth capital fund, venture fund, and so forth. And then I decided, secondly, to globalize it, to set up a fund that would be based in Europe, one in Asia, one in Japan, Latin America, Middle East, and so forth, so that we would have a geographic dispersion around the world in areas that we knew something about. And then so I did go around the world recruiting people to run those funds and then helping them to raise money for the funds. And then we controlled it all centrally, but we gave people a lot of leeway. And that's what we did. We globalized it and we made it a multidisciplined firm. And obviously others have done it as well.
Well, you've become this master interviewer. In my view, you've kind of taken the baton from Charlie Rose. How did that begin? What started your TV career?
Well, what happened was that at Carlyle, to get people to buy into our funds or invest in our funds or know about them, we would have large investor conferences every year, 1,000 people, 1,500 people. And to make sure people showed up, I would have a draw by hiring a former president of the United States or former secretary of state. And they would be a draw and people would say, well, maybe I want to hear about the Carlyle funds. I could read about them. But maybe I can hear, you know, President Bush or you know, President Obama or somebody. And so I would hire these former presidents or former secretaries of state or former heads of the Federal Reserve, would it be draws. And I found that when they were giving a speech, they were a little boring sometimes. And so I decided I would go back and ask the agent that was representing these various people if I could do an interview of them. I thought I could interview them and bring out their best points somewhat better than they would in their own speeches. And they said, as long as the fee is the same, they don't care. So I started to make people look, you know, more enjoyable, a little bit funny sometimes because I have a good sense of humor, and it worked pretty well. Subsequent to that, Vernon Jordan, a large, well-known lawyer, lobbyist, investment banker in Washington and New York, a very well-known person, asked if I would succeed him as the head of the Economic Club of Washington. And he said, all they have to do is get business people to come in and speak, and then you just introduce them and field questions to the members. I started doing that, and then I realized that the CEOs were very boring speakers also. So I decided to go to an interview format, and people liked it, and then Bloomberg picked it up, and then they put it on their TV programming, and it worked pretty well, and people seemed to like it because Bloomberg is seen all over the world, and people, I guess, generally like the style that I brought to that interview process, so that's how it came about.
We'll be back in a few minutes with our guest mentor, David Rubenstein. Go to our website, thementorsradio.com, and click on List of Shows to listen to past guests. This is Dan Hesse, and you are listening to The Mentors Radio.
And now,
Back to the Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm with Carlyle co-founder David Rubenstein. Remember, you can also listen to this show or any previous show via podcast on major podcast platforms like Apple, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart, or Stitcher on any device at any time. So in your book, David, you interview 30 leaders from different walks of life, and you found a number of common attributes. I think you listed 13, a number I usually stay away from. I would have picked 12 or 14. You picked 13, and ironically, number one was luck. People say that winners or leaders make their own luck, but I think you think it's even more than that, that there is some chance and providence that plays a role. Can you elaborate?
Sure. Everybody has some luck in life, good luck or bad luck, but you can make good luck, I believe, by knowing many people, reaching out to people, and having a good network, because you never know who might bring you an idea, an opportunity, or something that you might want to do. When I started Carlyle, I was able to do it because of contacts that I had made over the years by people I didn't really necessarily think were going to be helpful to me, but I just made a contact with them, and later on it came out, turned out to be useful. So my view is you make your own luck, and you can make your own good luck if you are willing to outreach, network, think of new opportunities that might come along, and don't be afraid to jump at some of these opportunities. Don't be afraid of failing, because everybody fails at some point in their life. And if you're afraid of failing, you'll never get anything done. So my view is you make your own luck, but you should be on the lookout for opportunities to make your luck be good by just taking advantage of situations you find yourself in or contacts you might develop.
You know, one of my guests I had earlier, George Brett, he talked about the importance of luck for him. At a high school, it was being drafted by the expansion Kansas City Royals. And he said, thank God I didn't get drafted by your Baltimore Orioles, because they had this other third baseman, this guy named Brooks Robinson, who was pretty good. It might have taken him a few years to get the starting role. So there is some luck involved for sure. So
George Brett was such a good hitter that I'm sure the Orioles would have put him in a different position and let him hit. But okay, I got your point. I got his point.
You've interviewed so many great leaders, you know, over the years. How do you whittle it down to 30? You know, what criteria did you use for this book to whittle it down to 30?
Well, when you're writing a book, you want to sell the book. So you want to have names that people have heard of. And so on the cover of the book, we have faces of people who are pretty well known. Mm-hmm. So people like Oprah Winfrey or Bill Gates. So I try to find people that have pretty good name recognition and the theory that people would want to read about them. And then obviously you have to have an interview with them that is reasonably informative and interesting. And some people are very famous. They give terrible interviews. Some people are not that famous. They give great interviews. So you have to have a balance there. There are some people in the book who are not as famous, but they gave great interviews, and I thought it would be worth having people read about them.
Well, you know, in your book, you describe life as really being divided into thirds, kind of the first phase being your education. Your second phase is you're kind of building your skills, kind of moving up the ladder in whatever your profession is, achieving, if you will, a leadership position. Your third phase, you're kind of, I guess, you're getting the benefits, you're enjoying the benefits of what you accomplished in phase two. But you also say that so many people who become our greatest leaders, people would not have picked them in phase one of their life as being somebody destined to be a great leader. Why is that?
Well, my theory is, and it's a theory, that sometimes the people who are the superstars when they're young, these are the people who are the high school student body president, the All-American athlete, the Rhodes Scholar, the White House fellow, whatever it might be, they have been used to getting so much attention, and they can get so, they've gone so far on their success as a young person, that maybe they coast a bit in the get to the second phase of life, and they don't work quite as hard. And you get people who are not so great in the first phase, people like me, who was not a superstar by any means. You just keep working harder. And these non-superstars, the tortoise, ultimately catches up and passes the hare because they've worked harder. And maybe the people who are the superstars early on don't work quite as hard. So that there are some exceptions to that. For example, there is one person I can think of in another book I'm writing about on the presidency. That's Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was marked as a superstar, a political superstar from an early age. But it was hard for me in writing this book about the presidency that'll come out in September to think of another person who's been president of the United States in the last, 100 years or even 200 years, who was thought as a child that this person's a superstar. So as a child, it's hard to see how any of our presidents have really been, other than Bill Clinton, marked for success. But obviously they came along, they did things that made them potential candidates for president. And so that's just an illustration of the fact that you can later in life become much more successful than you were earlier in life. And maybe that's a rationalization to explain my good fortune for not being all that successful early in life, but getting more successful later in life.
Well, that's a great lesson, especially for our younger listeners who may not be their valedictorian or captain of the football team. So you also list an important trait of successful leaders is the ability to keep learning, which is a concept I end each podcast with. Why should somebody who's achieved the pinnacle, achieved the top job, clearly because they know what they need to know, be focused on continuous learning? Shouldn't they be spending their time on acting and doing instead of learning?
Well, the world's changing. New information's coming out all the time. And now with the internet and so many different sources of new information, social media sources and other things, if you don't keep up with what's going on, you're not going to be relevant. You're not going to be able to function in society where it's moving so quickly. And so many other people have access to information and take advantage of that information access so that they can do things you can't do if you don't have that same information. So I think you've got to keep reading. You have to be intellectually curious. The people that really do well in life, in my observation, are people that are intellectually curious. They can't keep asking questions. They want to know more and they want to read more. And I remind myself all the time that you can't read too much. You just have to learn more and more. Otherwise, you'll become a fossil and you won't be able to communicate with younger people or people who are much more knowledgeable than you are because they read more than you do and you're just not reading very much.
Well, you describe persuasiveness as another important attribute. And you talk about things that contribute to persuasiveness, the ability to speak well, write well, especially leading by example. But you don't mention listening, which is something actually some of your, I remember Oprah in particular mentioned as an important attribute. And you're an interviewer, and that's something that you're really good at. And, I kind of grew up in my career as a salesman, and I thought that the most important part of sales was listening, because that's how, if you knew what was important to your customer or as a leader to your audience, listening really well was helpful. As somebody who's such a good listener, how come listening didn't make your list?
Well, the book isn't perfect, I suppose, but I did have an interview with Oprah Winfrey who said, and she's thought to be a great interviewer. She said she's not that great an interviewer. She's a great listener. And by that, what she meant was when she's doing an interview, she makes certain that she understands and listens to what the person says and pivots off of that. And I've often used as an example, the opposite was when some security officers, maybe the FBI, for example, come to me to do a background check. They have a list of 10 questions and I can give the answers and say to one of the questions, well, the person's really an axe murderer. But my observation, obviously tongue in cheek to some extent, is that the FBI person just goes on to the next question. They don't listen. They just want to fill out the form, fill out their 10 question form and go on to the next person they're going to interview. But you've got to listen to what the person's saying and pivot off of it. And I do think listening is an important skill. And when I go to make sales calls, which I've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years, you could say when I'm trying to raise money for Carlyle or other organizations, nonprofit organizations, when I start meeting with somebody, I don't say, let me tell you why you should invest with us or give money to us. I tell them to tell me about themselves, what they're interested in. Because when you understand what somebody is interested in and what they're thinking about today, you can pivot your argument about why they should do something you want them to do by taking into account what they've already told you. If you just go into a meeting and just say, here's why my product is great, and you don't listen to their concerns about what they're focused on, you're never going to be very effective as a salesman. You obviously pick that up yourself as a salesman, I'm sure.
We'll be back in a few minutes with our guest mentor, philanthropist David Rubenstein. You can listen to our show worldwide on iHeartRadio or on your favorite podcast platform like Apple or Spotify. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, Back to the Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm talking with author David Rubenstein about leadership. So, David, I'm actually not going to pivot on what you said last, because I'd like to get to a different subject, and that's the Magna Carta. So you bought all these fantastic American documents, but you shell out over $20 million for a document that's not an American document. Did you just want to brush up on your Latin? Why the Magna Carta?
Well, you're correct in observing that it's in Latin. It's in medieval Latin. But the answer is this. For one, it's a rare document. There are only 17 extant copies of the Magna Carta, 15 in British institutions and one in the Australian Parliament. And this is the only one that was in private hands and the only one that will ever come to America and be permanently here. So I thought, as a goodwill gesture to the United States and a payment for my good fortune here, it would be good to have this here and give it to the United States government. And I put it on permanent loan to the U.S. Archives, National Archives. Why is it important to this country? Well, when the Declaration of Independence was written, it was talking about rights that we had in this country that were being violated by the British. What were those rights? Those rights were the ones spelled out in the colonial charters that were given to the colonies initially. And many of those colonial charters were drafted by legal experts or statesmen in England. And they made certain to say in those legal charters that the rights of Englishmen, presumably the rights of the Magna Carta, would accrue to those people who are going to be living in the colonies. So you could say in many ways, it's more of an American document in some ways than an English document, because we went into a revolution because of our desire to protect those rights and enhance those rights. Whereas the British, you know, they for several hundred years really didn't pay as much attention to the Magna Carta as we did in the United States.
If I recall, one of the things in the Magna Carta was that even the king is not above the law. So,
well, that was the key provision in there. In the original version, there's several versions of the Magna Carta, but in the famous one from April of 1215, that one said that a council of 25 barons or wealthy landowners could overrule the decisions of the king. And because that was very upsetting to the Pope, who was then over the King of England, the Pope said to the King of England, "I don't like the idea that commoners can overrule your decision, because maybe they can overrule my decision at some point. So I want you to get rid of that provision or I will excommunicate you." So rather than being excommunicated, King John went to war with the barons and ultimately died in the war, and his 8-year-old son succeeded him. So you could argue that, it's a document that is historic in many ways, but it's a historic document as relevant to the United States as it is to England. And I think that was the reason why we should have one copy in this country.
By the way, where again can one see the Magna Carta? Where is it displayed?
It's a National Archives, which for those who don't know is in Washington, D.C. We didn't have a common way of keeping our documents that were government documents for many, many years. Finally, Congress, after about a 100-year debate, created the National Archives in the late 1920s and in the early 1930s. That building opened between 7th and 9th Streets on Pennsylvania Avenue. And that's where we keep our historic documents. That's where the Constitution is. That's where the Declaration of Independence is. That's where the Magna Carta is, the original copies. But now, because so many things are digitized, it's a different kind of organization. But they keep everything now that is a government document or a government digital communication.
Well, I'll have to go see it. I took Latin in high school. I'll have to see if I can, you know, if I capable of reading any of it. One of the other things that you mentioned, David, is humble demeanor. Is that something that is just attractive to you? Because it's something that I like to see in leaders and my mentors and role models had. Is that a trait that most good leaders have?
In my view, really great leaders are humble because they recognize that they had some luck to get where they are. They recognize that they're not as great as people might tell them that they are. Now, obviously, there are some leaders who are not humble, and they're always going to be the Napoleons or people like that. Presumably, Napoleon wasn't humble, and presumably somebody, Alexander the Great, didn't attach the name great to himself, probably wasn't that great, or that wasn't that humble, I should say, or Charlemagne, the same thing. But can you imagine Abraham Lincoln going around saying, you know, I won the Civil War by myself, aren't I great? You can't imagine that. Lincoln was our greatest president, in part because he kept the Union together, in part because he abolished slavery. but also he was humble about what he achieved. And I think that's one of the traits that I observe in really great leaders. Warren Buffett's a great leader as a business person. Can you imagine Warren Buffett saying, you know, I'm the greatest investor in the history of the world. Let me tell you how smart I am. That's just not his style. That's one of the reasons why people admire him, I think.
Yeah, I agree. One thing that some of your leaders mentioned, others didn't, but didn't mean it's not the case. They talk about supportive parents. It's something I know that you had, and I had. How important are supportive parents to creating great leaders?
Well, obviously, supportive parents can be very helpful, but we have observed that many people have been successful in life who did not have supportive parents, or who were orphans, or were raised in a foster home of some type. So obviously you can overcome those disadvantages, but it's a great advantage to have two supportive parents who want to help you succeed and do what they can realistically to help you. I had that with my parents. They didn't have money. They weren't educated, but they put all their energies into their only child, me. And so that was very helpful as I was, you know, trying to get somewhere in life.
Well, you know, I was fortunate to have supportive parents, and I think what it did for me is, especially my father, but my mother as well, they were really hard workers. And that's where you get your example. I mean, you talk about the importance of hard work to success. And one of the things that concerns me, and to my kids that are listening, they understand this, why I don't want to give them too much, is I want them to achieve all they can achieve, which they may not if life is too easy. But in particular, I think you can rob your grandchildren of success if their parents kind of had it too easy. You know, they didn't have to work that hard to get the nice house and the BMW. Is that your view as well?
Well, of course. I think that one of the hardest things to do in life for the last, you know, let's say 400,000 years that Homo sapiens have been on the face of the earth is to raise happy and healthy children. Nobody really knows the perfect formula for it. But we do know that raising happy and healthy children out of a wealthy family in many ways is harder than out of a middle-class family. Because if you are very wealthy, you have a tendency to spoil your children. And there's no evidence that spoiling children produces greater children. So how many people who are members of the Forbes 400 have produced children who are presidents of the United States, or people that have won Nobel Prizes? Well, maybe there's some, but not very many. People that win Nobel Prizes or achieve great fame and fortune in life are generally people that came from more modest circumstances and are not people that came from the wealthiest segment of society. So in my own case, I've never told my children what they're going to inherit from me, but I've told them just work hard, get a good education. I try to help them in that. But, you know, I don't want them to think that if they just sit around and do nothing, that they're going to inherit $1 billion when I die.
We'll be back in a few minutes to continue our conversation with David Rubenstein. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and we're with television host David Rubenstein, who has been sharing what he's learned about leadership by interviewing great leaders. So, David, my father was a huge Baltimore Orioles fan, and some of my fondest memories are taking my father and his grandchildren to Camden Yards to watch games. You have so many irons in the fire. You know, I described many of them, you know, in your introduction. It's got to take some time to be owner of the Baltimore Orioles. Why did you buy the Orioles?
I bought the Baltimore Orioles because I felt that it was a way to give back to the city that gave me a public education. I have made my philanthropy about patriotic philanthropy, which is giving back to the country, which made it possible for somebody with my last name and modest roots to be able to do reasonably well. But Baltimore gave me a public education. It gave my parents a public education. My parents lived their entire life really in Baltimore, and I felt I owed something to Baltimore. And one of the things I could do was invest in a sports team that's very popular in Baltimore. It's had some troubled times. It's actually doing well now. And I thought I could maybe add some value there and contribute back to the city that gave me a very good education.
Well, we're baseball lovers. So congratulations. That's great. So, David, how do you define the word success?
Well, if your mother is proud of you, what more do you want in life, right? So I guess trying to please your parents and have your parents, mother and father, think you've done a good job. That's pretty good success. Also, if your peers think that you have achieved something that's worth having achieved, I guess that's success. But also, one of the hardest things in life to do is to feel happy about your life and what you've done with it. And if you can be happy about what you've achieved and feel you've done something useful for your 80, 90, or 100 years on the face of the earth, that can be a success too. So not everybody's going to win a Nobel Prize or become president of the United States, but you can do other things that contribute to society. And if you feel you've done something useful for society and others feel that as well, I think that's success.
So my regrets is that my mother died young and wasn't able to see me achieve what I did in my career. Thank God my father could. You know, he lived to 95. You mentioned the word happiness. Do you define happiness the same way, or do you think happiness is different than success, or is like success a condition precedent for happiness?
Well, happiness is the most elusive thing in life. Very hard to be happy, in my view. And sometimes the higher you get in the totem pole of success, the least happy you are. Some of the most tortured souls I know are some of the wealthiest people I know, and some of the happiest people I know are not that financially successful. My mother was a pretty happy person generally, but she didn't have any money. She wasn't a particularly well-educated person, but she achieved happiness. Happiness is something that was in our Declaration of Independence, when Thomas Jefferson wrote that, to some extent, life was about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He never defined happiness in the subsequent 50 years of his life, but generally we have a sense that he meant the ability to achieve what you want to achieve and do something useful with your life.
Yeah, you know, I see the same thing, is just the number of extremely successful people who are not happy, who commit suicide, who do all sorts of things. So many people would think they'd like to live their life. But you're right, they're quite different. And I agree, happiness is a higher bar. It's harder to achieve than success. So leadership, you know, some people would say leadership's hard, leadership's a burden. Why do you find that leaders want to lead?
Well, I think leadership is something that you don't have to pursue. I mean, you can be a follower and have happiness as well. But I do think that there is an element of the human psyche that says, if I can achieve something and I can do something useful, I will be happier. And one of the ways that people can do that is by doing something which gets other people to follow you. In other words, many people will say that if they can get people to follow their views or do the kind of things they want people to do, that they would be happier because they've achieved something, they've gotten something done. So let's suppose you're Steve Jobs and you start Apple. Well, you're getting people to follow you about the importance of personal computers. And by doing that, you are presumably making yourself happier and you're being successful. And so I think leadership is something where you get a higher element of happiness if you're successful in it, and a higher element of pleasure out of life if you can persuade other people to do what you want and be a leader.
Yeah, you know, I've had this conversation, especially with younger people, about, you know, why would you want to be the CEO of a large public company? It seems like it's a real pain in the neck, you know, the quarterly earnings and all that. But you know, kind of following on, I think you can impact the lives and livelihoods of millions of people, you know, your employees, your customers, your shareholders, your communities, even your suppliers. So I think there, you know, I think it's a bit of a calling, almost like a vocation. I think leadership's like, you know, is a type of vocation.
Why are we on the face of the earth? Nobody really knows. You know, obviously the religious reasons God put us here, or we can have some evolutionary reason. We kind of stumbled into this unique place called Earth and life evolved. But it seems as if people who are on the face of the earth get greater pleasure by leading other people and by accomplishing something. So you're a leader as a writer, as a communicator, as a business person, as a sports figure. You lead other people to follow you. And by doing that, you get a sense of accomplishment that you've done something with the time on this earth that's meaningful and that's useful because you've made other people successful and happy by following you.
We'll be back in a few minutes with Baltimore Orioles owner David Rubenstein. You'll find all of our show notes and links at thementorsradio.com. For those who listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or on one of the many podcast platforms that carry our show, if you enjoy these conversations, please give us a good review and tell a friend. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm with patriotic philanthropist David Rubenstein. So on the subject of happiness, success, and leadership, David, you asked President George W. Bush what his proudest accomplishment was in his 8 years in the White House. Do you remember what he said?
That was an interview you're referring to that I did with George W. Bush and Bill Clinton together.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, George W. Bush, I think, would say today, and I have for a new book I have on presidents, I've interviewed him again, and I would say that I think he's most proud of the fact that his children love him. He felt that his two daughters didn't really want him to run for president. They were teenagers, and they said he was going to ruin their life. And he now says, my children love me, and I'm, you know, that's all I really want out of life, and they respect what he's done. But I would say beyond that, he had the pleasure of being the only person who was president of the United States and served two terms, and his parents were alive for both of those two terms. Can you imagine what it's like to be president of the United States and your parents are alive to see you, and they serve, he served two terms, and they were former president themselves and first lady. So no other president and first lady have ever seen their child become president and serve for two terms. That was a pleasure, but I would say his lasting impact, he would say, and probably most proud of is PEPFAR. PEPFAR was a program that he initiated to eliminate AIDS or reduce AIDS. And so far, he would say 25 million lives have been saved by the PEPFAR program that he kind of created with the help of Tony Fauci and Condoleezza Rice. So that's one of the things he's also very proud of.
Well, it sounds like you're writing another book on government or political leaders. And generally, when you're asked about which leaders you admire the most, you tend to cite, we'll call it government leaders. Outside of government leaders, are there any leaders, and let's say we can go past, so you can pick dead ones so you don't offend anybody who's still alive, but people outside of government, any leaders that you have particularly admired?
Well, there are many of them. Of course, in the sports world, the Baltimore Orioles had a great leader in Brooks Robinson, who passed away, unfortunately, recently. They also had a great figure in Cal Ripken. They were great leaders. When I was growing up in Baltimore, there was a great leader of the Colts football team, and that was Johnny Unitas. I also admire people who have humility and have dealt with tragedy in a great way. And Lou Gehrig is a classic example of that. Died of ALS in his late 30s and was very heroic in the way he handled it. Publicly, for sure. I've also greatly admire professional business people, and many of them, I would say, who built great companies from scratch deserve a lot of credit. Steve Jobs would be one. Bill Gates would be a second. Jeff Bezos would be a third. They created out of whole cloth companies that have changed the way we live and think and function. And they've done it in, I think, a really productive way. So I admire those business leaders, of course, as well.
Well, you know, the leader that comes to mind the most for me, and that I use the most in my talks and when I'm talking to others, is Sir Ernest Shackleton. Because I know you talk about the importance of leading by example. He was not only great at strategy, communications, empathy, but the example that he set. So he and his top officers would sleep in the wool bags, which were not as warm as the feather bags, which he let the men, if you will, the folks lower on the totem pole sleep in. He was special. So generally, you talk to leaders in so many different walks of life. Do you generally find more similarities or more differences?
Probably more similarities. I mean, people generally have the same qualities if they're leaders, which is they have typically certain drive. They have a certain perspective on what they're trying to achieve. They have a certain humility, in the case of really good leaders, certain intellectual curiosity, but a certain enjoyment of life. Now, obviously, some great leaders are unhappy, but generally, leaders feel that they've accomplished something, they're proud of it, and they're probably happier than many people who haven't been that successful. Though, of course, obviously, we know some leaders that are tortured souls, but generally most of the leaders I admire and know that I really admire are reasonably happy and feel they've achieved something worth doing. Now, you mentioned earlier that your mother passed away when you were young, and so she didn't have the pleasure of seeing your own success. As you may have noticed in my shows, I typically ask people, did your parents live to see your success? And the reason I ask that is because one of the great pleasures of life is achieving something and showing your parents what they created and what that person that they created did. So I know my own children, they like to show me what they've done, and I take a lot of pleasure in seeing what they've accomplished. And my own parents live to be old enough to be able to see what I had achieved, and I think that gave them a lot of pleasure.
You know, it's what gives me an incentive. I just hit a milestone birthday to stay healthy and to stay around for as long as possible, because I want to see that as well. Did you have any key mentors? This is the Mentors Radio Show. Any key mentors along the way that really meant a lot to you and to your career?
Well, I went to work initially for a man I greatly admired but didn't know him at Paul Weiss Law Firm. Ted Sorensen was there, and he was the brilliant speechwriter that was the counsel to John Kennedy, who I greatly admired. So I did some work for Ted Sorensen, greatly admired him. I brought into my firm at Carlisle Jim Baker, former Secretary of State, former Secretary of Treasury, former Chief of Staff of the White House, a person I greatly admired. I learned a lot from him. When I worked in the White House, I was working as the deputy of Stuart Eisenstadt, who was President Carter's domestic advisor, and he was a bit of a mentor as well. So there are a number of people that I can say are mentors, but probably the person who helped me the most was a high school English teacher I had in a public high school who taught me how to write reasonably well. And even many now, 60 years later, I remember his going over with me how to write much better, more clearly than I had known before. And that's something that made it possible to be able to write over these years in a way that I think is reasonably intelligible.
One of my great mentors was my high school English teacher my junior year, Miss Rotter. She taught me how to write. And by the way, one of the first biographies I read was Sorensen's biography of Kennedy, which was really, it was really a fine book. Well, David, you know, interviewing a master at the craft of the interview is a humbling experience for me. I want to say thanks for sharing your knowledge of leadership that you've gained not only by being a great leader yourself, but by interviewing so many talented and gifted leaders. As someone who also likes to go to our national monuments and museums, I appreciate what you've done to restore and repair them. To our listeners, please go to thementorsradio.com for show notes and other resources. You can also listen to us on the major podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple, and on iHeartRadio worldwide. Please join us next week for another edition of The Mentors Radio. Until then, this is Dan Hesse signing off. Remember, we're never too informed or experienced to stop learning.
It's been The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business. To get more information about the program or a sponsor, to download a podcast of today's show, or to leave a question for our host, go to thementorsradio.com. That's www.thementorsradio.com. The preceding program, copyright CBJ LLC. All rights reserved.